Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Hello and welcome to News Roast. My name is Julian Rubinstein.
My
name is
Hayden Prowse.
And this is three courses of conversation where we masticate over issues. We bend issues round like we're a sort of fork-bending magician.
We're Uri Geller's of conversation out here.
We're literally magicianing. We're Uri Gellering.
That's enough.
Wasn't Uri Geller like best mates with Michael Jackson? It got all a bit weird, didn't it?
He had all the weirdos, didn't he?
Yeah.
In his entourage. Well,
today.
Oh my God.
We are absolutely over the flipping moon to be joined by Noel Clarke, director, screenwriter, English actor, BAFTA award winner, comic book writer.
Yeah, I saw that.
Star of Star Trek, Doctor Who,
yeah.
Kid Adulthood, Adulthood.
I've made
his own pet. Listen, the man. This is a proper Renaissance man we're sitting with. So, Noel.
That's a good intro.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, no, thank you for having me. I was like enjoying your intro there. I was like, who is this guy? I want to meet him.
Bro. I mean, listen. Kid Hood and Adulthood.
Yeah, let's start at the beginning.
Like,
yeah, there's three now. There's Brotherhood as well.
There's Brotherhood as well.
Yeah.
But, you know, when we were coming up,
OAP Hood as well.
No, mate. That was Brotherhood. That's
it. Okay, fine.
Yeah. Midlife Crisis Hood.
But you studied acting, right? That was your medium immediately. But.
No.
Oh
no, I didn't. As I'm told often, clearly, no, I didn't. I kind of did. You know, I did GCSE drama and A level theatre studies, but couldn't afford acting. Couldn't afford drama school, man. Mm-hmm.
But you never studied how to write and direct a.
No, I didn't. Again, I did A level.
Film
I did like A level media studies, and I just. You know, I grew up like 50 yards. I grew up in West London, like 50 yards from Grenfell Tower. That's where my mum still lives. And, you know, it's council estate.
Yeah.
It was just me and my mum. And I didn't. Acting is like, you can't tell a parent who's come from Trinidad to better their life you want to do a job that doesn't guarantee a wage.
So how old were you when Kid Adulthood first came about, and what was the process that.
Well, I was.
How was that process? How did that work?
So I was, by the time. When it came out. I was 28, even though I was playing that character of Sam, who was 19-year-old sixth former, you know, and that was just pushing it.
It's because you got the baby face.
Baby face, man, black don't crack. I was actually 28. But it came out in 2006. We shot it in 2004.
Wow.
I wrote it in like 99-2000. When I was more like the age I could play the part.
A long time before
Yeah, I wrote it a long, long time before.
And that period was trying to get it. I mean, it's a huge thing getting a film commission.
Well, this is the thing. Like, I didn't even. I was just an actor at the time, and I'd barely started acting in 98. I started acting in 98. So I wrote that in like around 99, 2000, just because I was fed up of reading shit that I didn't like. I can swear on this fucking.
Yeah, of course you fucking can.
So I kept reading shit, and I was like, "This is bollocks, man."
Why did you know it didn't feel real? It didn't feel like an honest portrayal of what you'd experienced and your friends had gone through.
Yeah, it didn't feel like it represented me in any. So I started writing my own stuff. I didn't know how to get things made, and I wrote that, and someone liked it, and someone else liked it. Gave it to someone else who liked it, who had a bit more sway. Gave it to someone else who then got me an agent. This young trainee agent called Josh, who didn't have any clients, and like. Took me on as his first client. You know, like he basically
went on to do pretty well, didn't he?
He nearly runs the industry now.
Is that Josh Vaughan?
Yeah. I was his first client. He nearly runs the industry now, like over here. And
all because of you, obviously.
You know, I doubt it. But the success of those films in the early days would have helped us both, you know.
But Kid Adulthood, when it first came out, you know, it caused a huge amount of controversy.
Yeah.
It was incredibly controversial.
Loving his
You know, dealing with everything from you know, drug running, to knife crime, to people pressurising other people into all manner of fuckery, really.
Yeah.
And when you grow up in, you know, London, I grew up in North London, you grew up in West London, but it was quite identifiable.
Yeah.
Were you surprised by the effect it had? Because it was only released in quite a limited amount of screens initially, wasn't it? And then it kind of, it was like an earthquake.
It never increased the screens. It was on 42 screens.
That's amazing, isn't it?
It was only ever on 42 screens.
And this
gross,
is pre
gross
like,
millions, though.
No.
Gross. What was about, that the second one? What was
the second one? The first one, but
Hayes on point with his research today.
Yeah, but in relation to the amount of screens it was on,
yeah.
So it was only on 46 screens, but it did like about 500,000.
And it mustn't have cost you a lot to make Kid Hood as well.
It was about 600,000.
600,000.
But this was a BFI.
None of it was my money. No, it wasn't. Everyone refused it.
Oh shit, I thought the BFI were involved.
They did nothing. None of the distributors wanted to know about it. They were all like, this doesn't happen. That's why, even though it was made in 2004, sat on a shelf for 2 years because no one wanted to put it out.
Yeah,
after it was made.
Yeah.
Shit.
Sat on a shelf from 2004 to 2006 because nobody wanted to put it out. They were like, kids don't behave like this. It's too on the nose. Nobody really relate to this. These people don't go to the cinema. It was all that.
These people.
Yeah, it was all of that.
So then when it came out, you're like, nah, 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 nah.
Well, no, I mean, like, we didn't even...
It must have been a bit of I told you so about it. It's when you know...
I wasn't able at that stage in my life to gauge success or not. Yeah. So when everyone was running around going, hold on, this film made 500,000, which is nothing, on 42 screens, and everyone was running around going, this is amazing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
At that point, I wasn't able to gauge. I just knew we had a film that came out, and I was like, mate, that's great.
But it was quite iconic artwork. Like, it was kind of like that whole mood at the time that you had captured with a really disenfranchised youth that had very little to do with the sort of status quo society images that were going out. You know, you said it against the time. You know, we were still in the world of indie. Mm-hmm. You know, we were still in the world of Blur and Oasis, you know. And then adulthood, which had much darker themes, which, you know, obviously reflect the changing nature of...
Well, also the artwork as well. I just want to talk about that quickly. It's like, when they were first designing the poster, they had the characters against brick walls with graffiti and all this kind of stuff. And I kept saying no. We kept refusing. No, it doesn't work. It's not quite right. It doesn't look right. It just points at it at being a film that people on the tube could walk by and dismiss because it's seeing black kids on there with a graffiti wall is exactly what they expect to see. And we kept going and kept going until the sky was found, that blue sky, and the sort of skyline of West London was comped onto it. And we were like, yeah, that's the one. Because suddenly it gave it a different sort of feel. Mm. It made people walk by and go, oh, what is this? You didn't know if it was a CD cover or an album, like, you know what I mean?
Totally could be an album cover.
Mm. And I think those things made the difference. And then the trailers came out and the kids just related to it.
Totally. It's funny though, because if you think about like Trainspotting, like the first time you saw that poster and Kid Adulthood, like they're very memorable images.
So important.
And it's, especially in like such an oversaturated American market.
Mm.
But anyway, so then, you know, you're one of the rare people that I actually know who's got experience of not only making your own films, but you've... I mean, then you're in bloody Star Trek.
Yeah, I was, yeah.
What was that experience like?
Yeah, it was amazing. I mean, it's just a job, isn't it? Like, you know,
But I mean, compared to sort of like the realities of British film where everything's being done on a budget, when you walk, what's it like when you walk into
I'm a watcher and a learner, so what I realise being there is everything is just, it's just on a bigger scale.
Mm.
It's still budgeted. You still hear them saying, we don't have enough money for that. You still hear that because everything's just on a bigger scale. So where Kid Adulthood's made for 600,000 and there's no money to do anything, and then you get actors complaining they weren't paid a lot as well, there wasn't money, when that's like 200 million, but you're paying actors like 20 million.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Yeah. You're paying some actors like 10 million. Then your catering budget is like 4 million. So actually, essentially, you're still like scratching your head with the same problems, because it's just on a much bigger scale.
Yeah.
Would you like to direct films on that scale?
No. I don't think so. I think I'd like to do things like
pain in the ass.
10, 20 million.
Mm.
When you're doing them at 200, your studio's over your shoulder at all times, and essentially you probably have very little say.
Actual control.
You know, and I think at around 10, 20, you probably still, that's small sweet enough spot for the Americans to like, whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah, you control it. Yeah.
If you're giving advice to someone who, you know, is listening to this, who feels like, you know, maybe they've just they're just, you know, doing their drama B Tech or something. They don't feel they're part of the industry, you know. And you've got a script. Like, how would you advise them to go about trying to get something like that into? Because the world of features is a different world. It's not a world me and Hayden have massively been a part.
It is very, it's very difficult, man. I mean, it's very, very difficult. I would say, do as much as you can yourself. Create as much of a package as you can yourself. Like, mood boards. Make sure you've got your script fully written. If you have the capacity to shoot a little bit of a teaser, even if you're using your phones or whatever like that, do that, because that's the stuff that's going to attract agents' attention, because you really need either producers or agents to really, you know, sometimes it's hard to get to producers without having an agent. sometimes it's hard to get an agent without having material or people that want to back you. So it can become like a vicious cycle. So you just need to, the advice is to just graft as hard as you can and just find those access points.
But did you, how much time before you wrote the script or while you wrote the script did you spend sort of studying the craft of script writing, you know, like suspense, jeopardy, character, all that kind of stuff?
Well,
because that's, you know, it's one thing having a voice and understanding the voice of that particular part of London at that particular time, but it's another thing understanding how to, you know, sculpt a script in a way that is actually engaging for audiences.
Well, what I did was, because the voice is just a voice, it's just how I write. What I did was, when I decided I didn't like what I was reading in the auditions and stuff like that, instead of just moaning about it, I went and bought screenplays.
Of the auditions that you were doing?
Like just of films that I... Faber and Faber, the publishers, used to publish screenplays. I don't know if they still do it. They used to publish actual scripts. And I just went into Books Etc. at the time, Waterstones wasn't about, and I just mined the shelves and bought screenplays of like American Beauty, Clerks, Mallrats, Chasing Amy, Pulp
Amazing
Fiction,
films.
Fucking
sort
Go,
working out what's
Magnolia,
compelling about those scripts.
And I would just sit down and read them.
Yeah.
And I'd look at how they formatted it. I'd look at how, okay, oh, there's that there, there's a beat there. The middle part is where, no matter what they want here, the middle part is either when they've got it and they're going to lose it.
Yeah.
And they deserve to lose it, whatever. Or they're the furthest away possible from it. And then they get it back over here. And I just literally used to sit down and just read them. And you'd read all these different films, but there would always be sort of a... In every film, there's a fucking pattern.
There's
like,
a pattern, isn't there? I mean, it's like...
You can say no film's original these days because essentially they all follow the same formula, generally.
I read Robert McKee's book when I was at drama school. I'd watch, like, Adaptation, you know, when Nicolas Cage is playing... it's Brian Cox.
No, it's Nicolas Cage playing his twin, isn't it?
Yeah, he's playing his twin, and then Brian Cox is actually playing Robert McKee, who's this screenwriting guru, if you haven't heard of him. And it totally fucked my head up.
Yeah.
Because it was like script, anti-plot, all this stuff. Yeah. And you're like, what? And then, you know, at drama school where I went, you kind of, you know, you're reading so many plays that it's just like you said, you know, there's a very distinct thing.
This is a very distinct thing.
You know, I heard it summed up. I was listening to Mark Maron's podcast, the WTF one, and Judd Apatow was on. And he just said, it's just about binary choices. Someone's either moving from being like a cynic to an idealist or, you know, literally from happy to unhappy.
Yeah.
And it's just their journey.
It's just
their
journey.
And you're plotting it. And actually, suddenly I was like, oh.
Yeah. And you get to a middle point when they go, see, I was right, I told you. And it's like, at the end, no, actually, I was right.
You know what I mean? Yeah, it's so true.
You know what I mean? It's just, that's all it is with all these films, you know. And I guess I just learned from there and I just started writing my own stuff. That was... what I wanted to do.
You've been part of a lot of iconic shows, though. You know, not many people can say they've been in Star Trek and Doctor Who. Do you have some, like, crazy, mad
preference.
Doctor Who fans? Like, who's the craziest fans, the Doctor Who fans or the Star Trek fans?
I probably have more Doctor Who fans, because Star Trek I was a small part of.
Right.
But Doctor Who, I was in it for a couple of years, and so... I mean, they're all great. Sci-fi fans are great, you know, and... You know, and also iconic show. Avida St. Pet was an iconic show as well. You know, it's weird because it's weird. A lot of things I've ended up doing are things that I watched when I was young, which
really?
Is kind of, yeah.
Did you watch Avida St. Pet when you were young?
Yeah, my mum used to watch it.
Really?
Yeah, she. I remember distinctly, like coming home from swimming lessons, and she would put it on and watch it, and I'd just sort of be sitting there and watching it, not really understanding it, but you'd recognise Jimmy Nail.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Mm. This is pre-Crocodile Shoes, Jimmy Nail as
well. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And then same with Doctor Who. I remember watching that. And Star Trek. I remember winning a colouring competition and going to see The Search for Spock.
No way.
I won a McDonald's colouring competition and got to go and see The Search for Spock, Star Trek, you know, and then to be able on set telling that to JJ Abrams and he'd be like, oh, have you got the picture? I'm like, I don't think I have it anymore, but
that's amazing.
You know.
Right. Well, listen, we need to crack into our meal. So what have you brought us for our lovely starter? First of all, do you like a starter? Do you like a good Sunday lunch?
Yeah, I like lunch every day.
So what sort of starter would you be into?
I tend not to starve myself. It's bad for the metabolism.
Do you do starter every day?
Well, yeah, if I'm in Soho House. If I'm sitting in Soho House, I'll do it with a starter. How can you...
Just a liberal elitist now. Starters for breakfast.
I'm middle class now, mate. Yeah.
I'm loving my... Come on, so what's your favourite starter then?
What, in real life?
Yeah, in real life.
Bit of prosciutto.
Prosciutto?
A bit of rocket and melon.
No way, mate. It's about a nice cold soup for me.
No, a
nice Italian gazpacho.
A little bit of duck.
Nice.
Yeah.
Or chicken liver pate.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, pate. Yeah, a pate with a little bit of well, I should.
A crudité.
It should be gluten free, but it's not. A little bit of sour, a little bit of sourdough.
Gluten free. Noel's gone super liberal.
No, I wouldn't be eating these if I wasn't.
He's eating hobnobs.
Noel is just nailing. Like,
Noel Clark demanded, waltzed into the studio and demanded hobnobs.
And he's had so far four.
This is the diva.
Not even offering them around.
He's the diva, man. Here's the thing, right?
He's put him right in front of him and he's just polished off 2/3 of all the hobnobs.
Without even tea.
No tea. I don't need tea. Listen. I'm munching these hobnobs.
I don't need tea.
These guys are running a professional outfit podcast here. They ain't even a selection of biscuits. Like, what kind of fucking shambles is this, man?
Ken Loach.
Can't even offer Ken Loach a Jaffa cake or a fucking scone.
Ken Loach had four different types of donuts.
You know what
Mate,
I'm saying?
He's way too socialist to even have a
donut. Couldn't even bring a man box of Krispy Kremes or nothing. Like.
Noel Clark, what is your metaphorical starter?
My metaphorical starter today is this issue about Donald Trump. President, well, there's many issues with him, but the president of the United States banning transgender people from the armed forces. It doesn't necessarily affect us here in terms of our army, because we haven't followed suit. But I just wonder if we're getting into a time where it's just acceptable to ban people because they're different, and where does it stop? You know, what if he turns around next week and he says, actually, do you know what? I don't want black people in the army either. Mm. Like, what, you know, or let's start with transgender. Let's start with gays. Let's eliminate all the gays. And let's eliminate all the blacks. Like,
so what's his reason? He just tweeted it, right?
He just tweets it. Like, yeah.
Has he said why he's...
No, I mean, there was a funny thing that The Daily Show did where they were just like, they showed, obviously, because this is what he always does, is he tweets something and then tweets the complete opposite, where he was just like, crooked Hillary stands against the LGBT movement. And they just said he must have just forgotten the T.
Right.
He just doesn't get it. But it's also,
so you think,
like,
he's just like fired it off and hasn't.
Well, I think there's
it.
A really dark side to this, which is that, you know, I'm with you, Noel. I think that, I mean, I felt like it with Brexit as well, but I think that there were a lot of basic liberal values that we thought were kind of givens now, like the end of racism, the end of homophobia. Not the end, but, like, you know, you've accepted these things are not good.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes.
Homophobia, racism, you know, anti women's. Sort of movements, pushing them back into the kitchen or whatever you want to look at it. And now I'm not so sure. Now it feels like things are on a huge slide.
It feels like the misogynists have a voice now.
Yeah.
They can say their disgusting stuff loud and proud and feel like it's okay because they're being told it's okay by the things that politicians and votes are doing.
Yeah.
And it's actually disgusting.
One of the scariest things, I think I've said this on the podcast before, the thing that there was this, the day he got elected... There's this Twitter hashtag called Day One, and there were all these videos that were sent on Twitter, and it was just this, because exactly like you said, like, it's like the signal goes out from on high, right? And there were these kids in a lunch hall in New Mexico, and they were just literally shouting at the little Mexican kids. They were just being like, "Build the wall, build the wall," and they were just standing in a circle around them in the playground,
and they feel that's acceptable because suddenly there's a person in a position of power. Massive position of power who says, I'm going to do this.
Yeah.
And actually, we're going to get rid of them. And
but just from
it filters down.
From a practical perspective, you were just saying before we came on that 15,000 trans people in the American army?
Yeah.
That's a significant...
It's not a small amount.
You could take a small country with that.
Yeah. Oh, what? Yeah.
I mean...
Yeah.
The incredible thing is that he hasn't served one day in the American military himself.
Yeah.
So he has absolutely zero understanding.
I can't remember I was reading this or was listening to it on a podcast, I think. There was this incredible story of this guy who'd been a Navy SEAL for years and years and saw some of the most like hardcore combat you can possibly imagine and had come out as trans and, you know, after leaving the military and he'd gone back and he met all his guys that he'd served with in the military and they were all completely accepting of him and it was all about his journey and it was fucking incredible. This guy was hardcore. And I was thinking of, remember that MTV celebrity fist fight where they got on and RuPaul was on it and used to batter everyone. Do you think RuPaul and Donald Trump in a ring, he would get battered.
Yeah.
He would get battered.
Do you know what I was thinking as soon as I heard this? Yeah. I wonder what Chelsea Manning thinks about
this. I was thinking
this.
That, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Well, she's written a piece in the New York Times about it.
Has she? What does she say?
She probably thinks it's because of her.
It's an interesting thing, isn't it?
Because obviously,
that is scary to think.
She may think it's because Trump could say something like, after the confusion of her and then she did this and betrayed the country, we don't want to take risks like that and with people that aren't, they can't, you know. He may.
God, that's
I can't understand. I can't quite understand the logic of it. Because
but that makes sense to me because he's that mad. to think, oh my God, this weird trans person.
Not even sure of themselves. How can they be sure of serving the country?
Exactly. Saw all these people being bombed in you know.
Also, who's the campus president you've ever seen in your entire life?
Yeah. Donald Trump is probably the campus president ever in history. And like, maybe the guy is just bottling up a lot of shit. Like, maybe he just needs to. It's always the ones that are like so far in the closet that they become the homophobes, isn't
it? Yeah, of course. Yeah.
But he's so odd if you think about everything. Like, when you really look at his skin, or when you really look at his hair, because you've kind of accepted it now. Yeah. You've kind of looked at it so many times.
Yeah. He is
so put together.
Yeah.
Like, everything is like.
Yeah, right. He's probably had work. He's probably.
Yeah, probably.
You know,
I mean, and the thing is, you know, it's easy to sit back and go, well, I'm not trans, it doesn't affect me, I'm not gay, it doesn't affect me, I'm not LGBT, whatever, but it's a bigger issue than that, because, you know, like I said, if next week he just turns around and says, well, actually, these guys are now not allowed to do this, or these guys are now not allowed to do this, it's like, that's not cool, man. It's not cool. And also, I don't get the logic. Like, I tried to work it out in my head, if he came out and said, you know, in combat times, it's for their own protection, that if someone who is trans gets captured by opposing armies, the things that could be done to them, blah, 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 blah.
He just didn't
men who are women could be raped, and women who are men could, like, if I was like, well, maybe it's a safety thing, but I can't understand the
logic.
That's
just too many characters for his Twitter feed.
It's too many characters for Twitter feed. And then you would think, well, then if you're scared about that, then you wouldn't have women soldiers, because if they get captured by opposing armies, then there's war crimes there as well.
I don't think we should try and make sense of Donald Trump's policy decisions. I think he's basically playing to his base, who are Midwest, Rust Belt, kind of backward, pretty uneducated. Yeah. There's an interesting article which I have. No, there's an interesting book whose name I forget, which is about the link between the prescription drug epidemic that is currently sweeping America and the states that voted for Trump. There's a huge prescription drug epidemic which is sweeping Rust Belt areas, because there's just fuck all going on. There's no jobs. And there's the only industry that really exists is trading these kind of really strong, you know, some of these. America's addicted to them now, and like, because there's a lot of gang warfare and people are doing these terrible things, and they're taking these drugs to forget about it.
Yeah,
like, I mean, like, it's got to just be really affecting people's brain.
Do you know
power.
What? There's another theory though about this, which I think is a lot scarier.
Yeah.
Which happened the first time I kind of heard it being proposed was around the time when you started hearing about the Muslim ban and stuff like that. Which is just the dead cat technique, which is that you say something so shocking to distract attention away from
something else.
It's linked to all the Russia shit. He's just saying something.
It could just be the Russia stuff. I mean, it was announced, you know, last week that he just sort of slipped in that after meeting Putin for the first time at the G20, a week and a half later, they said that actually he had another secret meeting, which no one was at, and his advisors weren't even at, that he then said, oh, no, I was at that. But also, what I really remember from the time of the Muslim ban was that the only newslet to really report this initially was Al Jazeera.
Yeah.
And they came out and said that actually there were 30 executive orders that had been passed exactly the same time that the Muslim ban was. And they were things like, we're closing down the Environmental Protection Agency.
Right.
Which is a huge thing.
It's just a distraction.
But I'm not saying it is, but I'm saying that I think we have to look at his actions.
Now would be
the
time. He's about to, or he may be about to fire Jeff Sessions, right? Who's the guy that he put in charge because he thought he wouldn't pursue this investigation into him over the whole Russia fiasco. Yeah. Jeff Sessions recused himself from that because he'd had this meeting with this Russian ambassador and said, I can't do this because I'm slightly compromised. So he's going to fucking fire him.
Yeah. Yeah.
he's essentially saying, unless you do my bidding, irrespective of what the law says, I will just, your axed.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, as I got older, I always thought that we have a president, we have a prime minister, but they're not really in charge. There's people around them that are kind of going, well, you can't really do this, let's do this, and they're advising. But it seems like there's no advice.
Yeah. Mm.
It seems like either there's no advice, or
he's got his daughter.
He isn't the dangerous one, and it's the people around him that are, he's just a puppet, and it's the people around him that are essentially making the decisions.
I don't know, I think he may find himself coming up against some quite, I mean, he already is, right? He's coming up against the FBI, like the whole military industrial complex. He's got a lot to contend with, you know? His own senators right now are voting, putting in legislation to stop him getting rid of Russian sanctions. Like, he's quite an, I think he's building himself a you know,
I just don't,
his
just,
own grave.
It's just confusing, and I don't see why if trans people are capable of fighting, why shouldn't they fight? Like, I don't see what the...
Do you think it's just inbuilt prejudice? Because, I mean, the thing I find weirdest is, in his old life, as a New York billionaire playboy, he was part of the kind of New York scene. Like, what do you make of it? Like, what's your...
I don't know, because he was quite... Obviously, he maybe always was a Republican, but I've heard rumours that he wasn't.
Yeah, totally.
The Clintons were at his wedding.
Yeah.
His family was poor before him, like, back in the days. Self-made people. So...
I think the money came from his granddad.
But I really don't know. I really don't get it. But it's definitely concerning. I just don't know. I just don't know what the deal is or why
totally
people
right. The Roy Cohen, I think his name was, who was the lawyer who he grew up with, who basically was, you know, one of the guys that he looked up to most as he was growing up, because I think he was his father's lawyer as well, was a very famous gay lawyer in New York who died of AIDS. Mm. And he was very close to the Trump family, and he was kind of his mentor.
Yeah,
so you're right, he's part of this really metropolitan...
But this is, you see, this is what freaks me out.
Yeah.
This is what really starts worrying me, because I think that, like, Steve Bannon, right, who's the scary guy in the background who used to write Bar, he was a fucking movie producer. You start saying things like...
Wow, he produced weird, like, conspiracy films.
He produced Hollywood features, right?
Really, as
he
well.
He was like...
Good?
No, it's not even that they're good. The point is, I think this guy understands shock, right? He understands spectacle. And what I'm saying is, it's like, you say something like, ban trans people from the military. That is a hashtag that's trending all over the world. You got outrage. They're not stupid. Like, they know that's going to create outrage. Mm. What is going on right now, legislatively... That we're not looking at, because understandably, we're completely outraged. Because in a way, like, the Muslim ban showed that executive order is unconstitutional. Mm. I cannot believe that banning people of any sex or gender is constitutional. Mm. But what's happening right now? Like, what is really...
That's
like
a good point.
And I think that's the thing that kind of, like, really worries me about this presidency, is it's like, there is only so much that you can do, you know, sitting in your house looking understandably outraged. But I think we've got to just make sure we don't get too sucked in. Because like you said, it's like, he can just tweet.
And he's just changed the world. What are they going to literally fire all these people?
I don't know.
Do they literally fire him? 15,000 people are now out of a job?
Yeah.
They got to get shipped. If they're on deployment, they got to come back. Like, what's the deal?
Yeah.
I have no
idea. What if some of them are not even out?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I would be damn sure a few of them wouldn't be out. They've just kind of done their thing.
Thought
you know
about
what I mean?
Transitioning, yeah.
Or maybe they've already changed and are currently men or women in their thing, and people don't know.
Yeah.
Go to the toilet privately, you know, people don't know. And suddenly, why are you getting shipped back, John? Well, I can't.
It's crazy, isn't it?
Yeah. No, Clark, what's your metaphorical main for us today?
My metaphorical main today is the whole Grenfell Tower situation. I don't know, man. I don't know what the disgusting lack of information, lack of clarity, lack of numbers, lack of news. You know, I know people that are directly affected, like my friend that I've known for 22 years and two boys I know for 22 years. And, you know, we still don't know. The number stands at 8. The number stands at 17. The number stands at 29. The number stands at 80. What's the fucking number, man? You know, what are you not wanting to tell us?
I think this is the first time that we've had an opportunity in this series. First of all, obviously, to anyone who's listening to this who's affected, we've thought about this so much, and our condolences go out to you. And it felt like it was a tragedy that sort of unmasked all of the completely gruesome realities about the sort of quite grotesque underbelly of the totally two-tier system we live in, where people who are encapsulated in wealth can talk about cutting the red tape to, you know, stop like fire regulations, monitoring of buildings, you know, the I think it's the 76 Tory MPs that voted for what's the term again?
There was 76 Tory MPs that, I think it was 76, that are landlords that voted against legislation that basically would have improved fire safety and health and safety in buildings, exactly like that.
Yeah.
And it's buildings fit for human habitation.
Yeah. I think that was
disgusting.
Yeah, that was.
Yeah, but you have to understand the bigger scheme and why they're doing this is because, particularly there, like, I want to, you know, let people know, like, I knew my other friend's dad managed to get out.
Jesus, man.
My wife knows people that, again, managed to get out. A family of four, and they were expecting, which now they're not because of smoke inhalation and stuff like that. My mum knows people. My mum lives 50 yards away. She's within the cordon. Like, they're offering her money. Like, she's so close. Like, she's being offered money and stuff.
Was she there? Did she see it happen?
Yeah, she saw the whole thing. Because, you know, I lived there. I lived, like, 50 yards away. Yeah. I worked in the sports centre. This is where I know Jessica's uncles. I worked in the sports centre on the other side, 50 yards away. Like, no exaggeration. Yeah. Like, 50 yards away. I've seen fires in there before. Yeah. We've seen a fire brigade. We've come out. There's been a fire in the building. Yeah. It burns out within the flat. Always. I lived there 27 years in the shadow of that tower and saw all that stuff. And this new cladding that they put on is the thing that really made it go up. Now, here's my point. They voted against that stuff because they don't want people to live in nice buildings so that the people can move out. Because that fucking land is prime real estate.
Totally.
That land, that Grenfell Tower that everyone looks at, oh, sad, and there's five other towers, right? Two things. One is Kensington and Chelsea. It's 10-minute walk from Kensington High Street. It's 10-minute walk from Portobello. It's 1-minute walk to Latimer Road Station. Yeah. There's various bus stops. 5-minute car drive to Westfield. It's fucking prime,
totally
prime real estate. The reason they don't sign legislations like that is because they want it to be uncomfortable living. They want it to be a place where people get so fed up, they want to leave. Because when they leave, buy the flats out, the council will own them back again. They either sell them, do them up and sell them, or they keep them so that eventually there's less and less people. Then finally they go, there's only 20 of you in the block now. We're knocking the block down. Yeah. Here's 50 grand. Off you go. Go live in Huddersfield, whatever like that. Mm. And that was the beginning of that shit. My mum lives 50 yards away. My dad lives in one of the other tower blocks, only about 100 yards away. He gets letters all the time about them wanting to knock that stuff down. Mm. Right. The second point is that tower, out of the five that are there, was the only one that was refurbed. That was the only one that was refurbed because the new buildings at Latimer Road Station, just next to Latimer Road Station, that look that way, when they look out the window, they saw the ugly tower block. Mm. And to increase the prices of those properties, you know, or to make sure they maintain their value, you don't want to look out your window and see a horrible looking tower block, so they refurb the fucking block. The other four haven't. My dad lives in one. They haven't been refurbed. There's a lot going on here. Yeah, there's a lot going on here.
That's not even a conspiracy theory.
No, that's fact.
There's government. When the government came in 2010, they began cutting local council budgets. Everyone knows this, right? And there was a directive that came out a few years later, which said to all the councils that had these huge deficits because of the cuts, they said, look, if you can't pay for shit, you need to sell off the prime real estate that you currently own within the council. Mm-hmm. That is what councils have been doing for the last 5-6 years.
They've been trying. My dad owns his one, though. That's the problem. Right. So some of the blocks, 20 years ago, they did right to buy.
Yeah.
So a few people actually own them, which makes it more difficult. Totally. But the renters are like, here's 40 grand. Yeah. People are like, 40 grand?
And it's not even...
I'll take that. Where can you live? Derby.
It's not even like... Totally. It's like, I've had friends that went to like property fairs in places like China, and there are councils. You have like Kensington and Chelsea Council or Haringey Council out at property fairs in China selling off real estate to middle-class Chinese people that want an investment in London because it's going to make them millions in a couple of years.
Yep, 100%.
Fucking nuts.
Yeah, but... That's people
that live there that are being kicked out. So...
Slowly gentrifying. But what you have to understand about that particular area is we already know once it all happened, it was all on the news, Kensington and Chelsea, richest borough in the country, one of the richest boroughs in the world. That particular area is so prime. Mm. It's so prime. Because who doesn't want to live 10-minute walk from Kensington High Street?
Yeah,
who doesn't want to live 10-minute from Portobello?
Square mile is probably more money in that area than
I'm telling you.
The stuff I think that it also uncovers is this, the grotesqueries of the system itself. So, for instance, as Hayden and I were saying, it's actually 72 MPs who voted against the motion to make houses fit for human habitation. But one of those was a guy called Nick Hurd, who's now the police and fire minister. Right. Mm. So Hurd makes at least £20,000 a year from a rental income from a two-bedroom flat in Ruislip and a house in London. And today, he is the police and fire minister who's leading the government's response to the Grenfell tragedy.
Mm. Not in a compromising position then.
This goes back to what Monbiot said in his piece that we were watching in The Guardian earlier on.
If you haven't seen this, you should watch it. You got really angry. Do you remember we were talking about that? That Monbiot video? About where he says Grenfell is the cowards. Yeah.
And I thought, what? And then I had to listen to it. Yeah.
So there's an investigation, right? But in what other area of, you know, the public sphere does the person that's, you know, presumably being accused of being the criminal in the scenario get to define the terms of the investigation?
It's ridiculous. It's like me killing you and then investigating the murder.
So I prefer it if
sounds
we didn't...
like you do that in one of your movies.
Yeah. Right, I've killed him. Who's going to investigate? I'll investigate. innocent.
That's a sound idea.
Yeah, I'm innocent, guys.
Yeah. Let's not investigate the murder. Let's just investigate what happened around the murder and who was there at the same time.
I wasn't there, but you murdered him, but I wasn't there.
Just to say, if you haven't seen this video, so George Monbiot, put in George Monbiot plus Grenfell Tower, you'll find it.
Yeah.
But what he talks about there is the fact that Oliver Letwin, who is part of a group called the Red Tape Initiative, who have gone about, people completely isolated, encapsulated in their own wealth, cutting red tape of health and safety because it makes corporations more money. Yeah. And at some point, I think in 2004, Letwin said, the culture of red tape makes Britain a nation of cowards, which really is kind of like that whole thing of like not affording people the protections.
It's all right for Letwin, isn't it? He doesn't have to live in a tower.
But let's just be really real. This is about race. This is about fucking race and poverty and class.
Thing about that area, a lot of migrants there, you know, Somalis, a lot of people that essentially,
because that's where we were dumped, mate.
That's the Windrush. It's the heart.
That's
of the
where
Windrush.
We were dumped when the 50s and 60s and all that. When they black people coming over, they were like, right, put them in Labbot Grove, put them in Brixton.
But even
that's
more,
where
even
they were
more
dumped.
Recent, and recent migratory,
recent know, more like recent migratory people, because obviously they were like, where do we go? And was like, well, you can go there with those lot, and that's why that's what happened.
Yeah.
That's what happened, man.
No, do you think that there's a chance that the numbers were suppressed to make sure there wasn't a riot?
100%. I think that first is right initially, you know, because if they were like, boom, boom, it's this, people would have been fuming.
Because it did start feeling like that. It did start feeling like that.
And also this insurance thing that I hadn't heard, but that's interesting too. I mean, I was down there day one, like when we're off air, I'll show you something. You know, I was down there day one. By 9 o'clock, I was down there getting my mum out because they weren't sure if it was going to fall down. We went to Westway. We made like 200 beds in Westway, put up a big partition so that single people could be on one side and families could be on the other.
I remember seeing on your Twitter.
The next day, there was like 2 beds slept in. And we're like, what the fuck? They said there's only 8 people dead. Everyone's fucking dead, mate. There wasn't.
Fucking hell.
Do you know what I mean? There's only like 2 beds slept in. Like, I'm not even embarrassed to say it. We thought there'd be, everyone would come there, sleep, you know, some would be in the hotels, but people immediate. A lot of people died, man.
The thing that disgusts me the most, right, is it's like, look, this was unprecedented, right? So let's give, you know, Hayden and I have both met with the first responder firemen who were there.
I worked with one of them. He's in the sports centre as well. This is how close I am to these people.
And they're amazing.
My mate Dave worked in the sports centre with me and Jessica's uncles, like, and he was one of the first responders.
But heroes, I mean, like, I'm never going to take it away. Like, hearing the stories heroes, of those people going
that,
up like
some
one
of the shit they were saying.
The point that they've made to me, the point that any number of people have made to me was on day one, this was a national disaster. There should have been an emergency command centre set up saying all the resources of this country, the army, the navy, the home guard will do absolutely everything to screw you. There was nothing.
These are migrants, the poorest people in the country, and frankly, the government doesn't give a fucking shit.
They weren't prepared anyway. Nobody, that tower, and I'm not defending them, but like I said to you, I've seen fires in there and they burn out. The variable is the cladding. Because I've seen fires in there. I lived there 30 years. I've seen fires get put out, burn out in apartments. That cladding turned that thing into a chimney, turned it into an oven. You know, and I don't think, and I'm not defending them again, I'll say, but I don't think anyone could have prepared for that. You couldn't, they weren't prepared for it.
The thing that I hadn't realised in speaking to these, to the firemen, it just suddenly hit me. It's like, obviously what happened after 9/11, like, you know, 5-6 years after 9/11, all the firefighters died of like asbestos related diseases, cancers, because of the shit they were breathing. Speaking to those firefighters from Whitechapel Station who were down there, they were saying to me, well, look, obviously after our half an hour of air ran out from our oxygen tanks, what did we do? We went back in. So they all went back in without oxygen tanks.
To save
and
people.
The next day or a day later or a couple of days later or something, they got an email from the Home Office, because that's who employs the fire services right now, saying, we tested the asbestos levels around the tower on the night and they were below safe levels.
Yeah.
But it's
they
so
hadn't
disgusting.
Even thought about it. And they turned around and they're like, hold on a second, we were at the tower all evening. Where were you with your asbestos testing facility? We didn't see you.
But I can't even...
What
this
are
is
you
what,
talking
so
about?
So here's the real issue. In 2017, why was there still asbestos in the building?
That's insane. Exactly.
Because they removed it.
That's the real issue.
Because they've removed it from most government buildings. You know that.
That's the real fucking
issue. Why haven't they removed it?
Why was there asbestos still there?
Yeah.
That could even catch fire, and you know that should have been cleared out years ago.
Look, you spent a lot of time down there. Like, what has been the like public?
I'm down there all the time.
That's what I mean.
I take my kids to see my mum. It's there. Like, I'll show you when we come off. Like, how close it is. It's there. You know what I mean? The public mood is somber. You know what? What it has done is made the galvanize the community. everyone from young, what would be called road kids, to like elderly are like galvanized together. You know what I mean? People are supporting one another, and I think that's a good thing. It's a pretty tight knit community anyway, but people are angry, man. Like there's how can they not have word of what's happened to their daughter?
Do you think?
Like we clearly know that, you know, missing is now probably most likely not coming back, right? Mm. We know this, but why have they got no fucking official news? It's disgusting. You know, these are people. Like, you can't even give them some sort of explanation, or like, we think that this may have happened, or we think that this. No, they haven't even like received a thing like, okay, she may have died. Like, nothing. Mm. This is nothing. You know, that's not acceptable, man. Not acceptable.
Can you see anything positive that could come out of it? And you say people have, like, you know, come together over it. Do you think it's changed the national narrative and the way we see the government that's current, you know, and the way we
Well, the government
think
doesn't,
about
the our... government needs to be out for a start. But I mean, I'm not one to say that.
I think it's politicising people.
Yeah, yeah. But I'm not to say that any other government would be any better, because the truth of the matter is politicians are out for themselves. That's the truth of the matter. Even the party I support, if they were in power, they would probably do a lot more to help people that are disenfranchised. But at the end of the day, they're still going to be out for themselves. That's, politicians are like that. What this definitely shows, what they need to do is, we should be on them. Whatever they build in that fucking Towers Place has to be social housing. Not like, oh, it's terrible that this happened, we're now knocking down the tower, we're going to build these new apartments and all these fucking yuppies move in and they're worth like $2.5 million each, right? No. Whatever goes back there needs to be social housing for people in the community that cannot afford, that literally are getting pushed out daily, weekly, monthly, yearly, because they literally cannot afford to live there. And that's what needs to happen. Safe, clean, social housing. That needs to happen.
I mean, something that a couple of youth workers, I went to something down on a couple of Sundays ago down at the Westway, and this guy was telling me that he'd worked in the area for about 20 years and that, like, all the gang violence had stopped, and that there was this feeling that actually they could run their own community, and that there had been such a vacuum left by the council that they had no legitimacy to come back.
They don't.
Then you look at the pictures of kind of the council meetings.
Yeah.
What do you make of it? Like, when you look at it, because for me, sometimes I feel like I'm looking at like fucking House of Cards or something. It doesn't seem real. You know, like, it's so clearly the most ardent neglect of the 100%. Social contract between, you know, the public and the taxpaying public and the people.
Yeah, 100%. But you have to understand, you know, that borough is such an opposite end of the scale borough.
So polarised, yeah.
Yeah, it's such a polarised borough. Like, I've always loved living there. I've loved it because it's been the most amazing melting pot of
That's
an area.
Kind of what makes that area as well.
Yeah.
Like, you think about Animal Carnival, you think of the 100%. Difference between, like, Paris and London, and how Paris is so ghettoised and all the poorer people on the sort of, you know, the suburbs at the edge. But that borough and certain other boroughs where everyone's kind of together, there's an estate here and there's a £4 million
and there's
house
a £4 million
there,
pound, yeah.
And everyone kind of comes out, and my friend, you know, everyone's in this huge carnival
It's been the most amazing sort of borough. But consequently, what that does is the people in the councils are more concerned with what's happening below Kensington High Street and Chelsea and all that kind of stuff. And the north of the borough, North Kensington, they're like, they couldn't give a fuck about it. They're waiting for people to move out and go out so they can build new flats, and then the whole borough can be some gentrified fucking area. And that's, I think people are not going to have that. They're not going to have it. People will demand. When I'm not going to let, and they can't. People are not going to let them build some fucking block of apartments there, and suddenly all these people. It's not going to happen. That place has got to be social housing, or you cannot replace that tower with some gentrified luxury apartments that people are just going to come in and not give a fuck about the real people that live there. Because I lived there like 30 years of my life, and I'm one of the lucky people that worked hard, and I've seen both sides, because I lived there 30 years of my life. Now I live on the other side of the borough, so I've seen both sides, and I see the neglect from one side to the other.
Because obviously we've got listeners like up and down the country, and it, for me personally, like, when I actually saw, because I wasn't in London the day it happened, 2 days later I went down to the tower, and it was a completely different physical experience, going there, because it was like, someone said to me, I think as soon as I got there, they were just like, well, it's a vertical cemetery, isn't it? And that really hit me, and I think you can really feel it, actually. There's a kind of,
it's horrible,
it's just strange,
it's just there.
You're so much more involved with the community groups than I am. Like, for people actually listening to this, like, what can they do to get involved? Like, you know, there's the Love for Grenfell sort of site.
I'll be honest, I actually don't know now,
really.
I really don't know now, because so many things have popped up, and I don't, what I don't want to say is
yeah,
a thing.
Follow this, not
yeah,
that.
Follow this and not that, because some of them, you know what these things are like. People have popped up with things, and you realise a week later that it's not a real thing.
Yeah,
and they're actually siphoning money, and they're only giving £10, and they're keeping it. So I legitimately couldn't tell you.
Well, like, I can tell you for absolute sure that the Grenfell Action Committee is legitimate. Yeah, and I can tell you for absolute sure that Love for Grenfell, which is an Instagram page that links to Love for London, where you buy a T-shirt for £10, all that money goes directly to the victims. I mean, I
don't buy it. I never buy those things. Like, I know I'm dealing directly with families. I know, like, I know that we got flights for people's relatives to come over.
Yeah.
My missus has been to hotels and delivered clothes and delivered food. Mm. You know, we got like a gaming company because Eid was coming up and these kids had nothing. We got a gaming company to provide consoles for the kids, so they had something for.
Yeah, you were speaking to all the brands.
You know,
like, it was amazing.
That's what I'm doing.
But the thing is, what worries me, Noel, when we say things like that to a larger audience of people, is like, it's just further reason for them to become
disengaged,
more cynical. And actually, there were some, in the midst of tragedy, you know, there was community action. I'd never seen anything like it.
No, it's amazing. And this is why, like, they're saying the community could run the area. I mean, obviously, logistically, you probably couldn't. But, you know, the truth is that? Like,
Everyone who was down there, who was running the community, so it's just like Calais.
Yeah.
I mean, like, you know, Hayden helped help refugees.
Yeah.
Right, and you go to the warehouse there, and these people had no experience of looking after vast amounts of refugees who just come into Calais, distributing them food.
Yeah.
But it makes you go, hang on, actually, we're doing just as good a job as you're doing.
And that's amazing. I mean, that's basically anarchism. That's what was happening in Spain before the Spanish Civil War. There was Barcelona and Catalonia was an anarchist state.
The first few days, that's what it needs to be. That's what happened. Like, they weren't there.
Mm.
Like, we were down there.
Bottom ground up organisation.
But that is the most disgusting. Like, nothing about this situation makes me more angry. Yeah. Like, yes, the fire was an absolute tragedy. It could have been avoided by the cladding, but I don't think anyone was like intentionally like, let's burn these people.
No.
But the fact that literally within 24 hours, there wasn't a gigantic state response is, I think, in history, will go down as one of the biggest absolute disgraces of certainly, you know, since the turn of the century.
Because they don't care, mate. Because
they don't.
But if it happened on Chelsea on like one of those roads, they'd be down there in like an hour.
I mean, doesn't it prove though that we all need to? It's about collective organisation. It's like there's no one else you can rely on. And actually, the firefighters and the police and all these people, they are part of that society. Like you said, this firefighter, you work with him in the local sports centre. These people are part of the community. Forget fucking government. Yeah. Bottom up organisation, anarchist structures. That's the way forward.
I mean,
if anything good can come from that, and people coming together and realizing they have to organize their own infrastructure and they can't rely on these people that are just going to fuck them over.
I think there's a middle ground, like what Trudeau does in Canada. I think there's a middle ground with that, because I think with anarchist kind of things, they can't always work because there's always going to be people that are more interested in representing their specific kind of thing. You know, what Trudeau's done in Canada is he's got on his government, he has someone from this community, someone from that community, someone who's a liaison where he goes, well, I don't know much about these people, you can be our liaison. Mm. So like, if we're doing things by throwing our rappers out the window and that's against your religion, it's like, well, this is still a Christian country, but explain that to us and we'll make sure that doesn't happen.
I totally agree. He's the most progressive.
He's progressive.
Yeah.
You know, and I think you look at the councils, and you know, you need to stop looking at councils as being well-educated Oxbridge people
and be representative of
the people that live in your community.
Yeah.
I think that's the most fundamental part of it,
because you need to be able to relate. Like, you have a lot of Christians there, fine. You have a lot of Muslims there. You have a lot of.
But this is the problem, you see, because you and me see this as quite like, we grew up in London, right? So like, it all seems pretty obvious.
Yeah,
I reckon you talk to someone who lives in one of the UKIP areas, right? Like, not in my country, right?
100%.
I'm not having some Somali Muslim
100%.
Telling me what to do.
100%.
And it's like it's a big thing to do with this fight that is going on for the soul of this country. And it's about this idea that somehow we're endangering the national narrative, because our collectivism is somehow kind of like it weakens the old British narrative, which was built on the back of fucking empire, where we used to go and ransack countries, steal all their shit, rape their women, take their tea, and then fucking come back here and sell it all.
I learned recently, you know, I did a TV show I'll tell you about after, but I learned recently that my ancestors were people that were put upon. I don't want to, in case I'm not allowed to talk about the show, but were put upon.
Can't imagine which show this is.
And the people that were in charge of that stuff lived in Brunswick Square.
Fuck off.
In Soho. Yeah. So this country is renowned for going to other places and destroying them, you know, and pillaging them and all that kind of stuff. And then there's a small percentage of people over here, and it's like the world is ending. Like, Britishness, as its old school thing, is not in danger, but should evolve into what it is now. Mm. You know, is there's people of different cultures are born in this country. Mm. They're supposed to be British, but they're not made to feel British.
So we're going to go on to the dessert.
Yeah.
Do you like a dessert?
Yeah.
We're going to do this?
No, we're not going to do it.
We're going to do it. So come on then.
Bread and butter pudding or creme brulee?
Sticky toffee pudding.
Bang. I'd go with that. I'm with sticky toffee pudding, man.
Or chocolate fondant, you know, with a runny chocolate in the middle.
That's pretty big.
And some salted caramel ice cream on the side.
Have you ever done that thing where you get the sticky toffee pudding, right, and you put it in the microwave, right? And what are you joking? And you heat it up. Yeah. And I'm literally, I have burnt myself.
Yeah, it's really.
Probably worse on that hot sticky toffee pudding.
You're talking about the microwave sticky toffee.
Yeah, and you get it out quite quickly and you're watching something. You put it in. Yeah. And then you put the spoon
in. It's really
bad. Because it's basically just burning hot sugar that just caramelizes to your tongue.
Kim Jong-un uses that stuff as like a chemical weapon. He drops it from the sky.
Wow.
It's bad news.
Yeah. Just sticky toffee pudding. Just throwing it in through his intercontinental ballistic missiles.
Exactly. You can't load it.
My goodness.
Just loads the sticky toffee.
So no.
No. Yeah. Yeah. What's your pudding?
Well, my dessert is it's light, but it's not light. It's like so recently Emma Watson, wonderful, respected young actress, young actor, because I don't like to define people by, you know, being you're a woman, so you're an actress. We're actors. She just happens to be female, right? She recently, a few months back, had a big thing about saying we should remove gender from acting awards.
Okay, so this is like when it's like in the Oscars or the BAFTAs, the Oscar for best female actress.
So it shouldn't be like best actor. Yeah. It shouldn't be like best actor.
Right, okay.
And best supporting actor, best actress, best supporting actress. It should just be best performer in a lead role and best performer in a supporting role. Although it sounds like a great idea on the surface, it's something that really should be considered and thought about, because immediately after she said that, the MTV Awards were like, this is a great idea, and they did it. And they had only best supporting performer and best leading performer, and Emma Watson won for Beauty and the Beast best leading performer.
Probably because she said she'd turn up.
You know, MTV Awards is pretty big, man. I don't feel like they need people to.
Well,
you know,
it is.
It's not alleging like, corruption.
You know, there, no.
Some kind of like.
No, not at all. Not at all. I'm legitimately not. You know, but I think obviously they're making a point to make a statement. Now, here's the thing. That sounds like a brilliant idea, and as from our previous discussion at the beginning, you know, I'm all for equality and gender equality and all this kind of stuff. Here's the issue. Male actors get jobs still now in 2017 outnumber women in getting work like 8-1.
Wow, is that true?
8-1, right?
Whoa.
In terms of like proper, good, meaty roles. So we already know that you're outnumbered 8-1. If you suddenly take away awards and just make them best performance awards, who's to say that women are even going to get a nod or a look and nominated? Let alone someone who is non-gender identifying or anything like that. So thus, my point is with this dessert is, although I know Emma comes from a very good place in what she's thinking, I think she comes from a privileged place, and she doesn't realise that for a lot of people, this would be a very bad deal, because actually women potentially could be frozen out.
Yeah, because that's her whole thing, isn't it? You know, he for she and equality across the board.
I get it.
She was Hermione Granger. Like, she is a...
She's
a national treasure already.
She's a national treasure already.
And she's kind of never going to be particularly out of work. But, I mean, I'm interested, just to broaden this out a bit.
Yeah.
You are one of the leading black actors, you know, in this country.
Yeah.
You haven't had to do what, you know, Idris Elba had to do, what Riz Ahmed had to do, and go to the States to make it. You made it here, then you started working in the States. What did you make of the whole kind of like, you know, white faces at the Oscars, white faces at the BAFTAs, and then Moonlight winning, you know, and stuff like what do you sort of see the makeup?
I don't get involved in it, mate. Like, I feel like it's easy for people to sit around moaning about this, that, and the other. But yeah. I just get on with it. It is what it is for me.
But you also create your own work.
And I just create. Yeah, it is what it is for me. There's no point in me jumping on the hashtag. I get it. I watched it. I'm like, I get it. It's disgusting. It's not right. But, you know, at the same time, I don't want to be given an award because they're trying to make numbers.
Yeah.
I don't want to be. Don't give me anything because you're trying to tick a box or make numbers. Or fuck, we don't have enough
affirmative
black people.
Action program. Let's give
it. Don't do it. I want to get that shit because I was good enough to get it.
Yeah.
So what I don't want is them to just start giving awards to people of color because they're trying to not have a hashtag trending about them. But actually, at the grassroots level, teach people, whether it be crew or whether it be actors and writers and cast, let people learn, come through the system, so that in 10 years' time, someone of color can win without it being like
a thing,
or we've ticked a box. But because that the roles are there and there's enough jobs there, and women as well. And I think I get Emma's thing. I get it. Like, I love what she's doing with her feminist.
The he for she stuff.
Yeah, I love it, you know. And I think in a lot of aspects in society and in life, it works. You're doing this job. A woman's doing this job. Why shouldn't she be paid the same as you?
Yeah.
100%.
Well, we're three feminists here, aren't we?
But here's the thing. If she's alone on that channel and 10 people watch, and you're alone on that channel and 500 people watch, then there's a difference in your value. And then it's not about like she should just be paid the same because it's the same job. There's a difference in value. Now, those things have to be considered at all points. You know, it's not just about, but if she's doing it and 500 people watch, and you're doing it and 500 people watch, and she's getting paid like 20 grand less, that's not acceptable.
So listen, we don't work in the film industry, but for people who do, who don't work in the film industry, who might be listening, people often talk about like sales figures and you basically have a film and you attach a star to it.
Yes.
And that star, you know, he can sort of like, or she can muster a certain amount of audience in different national territories.
Yes.
Just explain to people how that works. And because what you're saying is like, you know, obviously, you know, 500 people watch that or one person watch that. But for people who maybe don't understand the film industry, how does it work?
In the film business, there's, you know, films are sold as commodities to territories. You know, so for example, if you use me as an example, you could probably finance a £1.5 million film off myself. Because
Of you being like the lead
of
actor.
Of me being the lead actor. Right. Because they'll look at the territories that my film's selling.
And when we say territories, we're talking about countries here, aren't we?
Countries, like Britain, the world, China.
Britain actually isn't a very big territory globally, is it?
It is in financially. It can be financially, yeah. Eastern Europe. Now, straight away, if I'm the lead and stuff like that, Eastern Europe's generally out. China's generally out.
You're not big in the game in Eastern Europe.
No, there's barely any black people there. Do you know what I mean? China's definitely out. Japan's definitely out. Spain, Italy, countries that we kind of love to go on holiday, but inherently racist in terms of the film business.
Yeah, interesting.
Right? So you're up. So your value goes down. But they know UK-wise, you're good. Now, if then you put someone like Sam Claflin, for example, white face, Eastern Europe's back in, Japan's back in, places are back in. So if he's the lead in a film, not only will the budget be higher, he'll probably be paid more than me. That's the way shit works, and that's kind of acceptable, because if you can't sell it to all these places off me, then the budget has to come down. And that's what they do with men and women and all that kind of stuff. What I'm talking about generally though is if you're on the same star power, regardless man or woman, you should be paid the same. And more importantly, what I'm talking about is the fact that I think with the massive discrepancy in the amount of jobs there are for men and the amount of jobs there are for women, taking away two awards from award shows would potentially be very damaging for...
The Oscars would be half as long.
It'd be half as long. And, you know, and it would be great if you did that and a woman won it. It'd be great. Mm. But then what happens for the next 10 years when there's, you know...
But also there are still different roles, right? I mean, there is still a difference between perhaps... I mean, I'm 100% behind you. There should be much more female protagonists. That's about writing apart from anything else. People like you need to write the roles in which women are starring in. Yeah.
So this is what I'm saying. So Emma's point is actually... It's misguided.
She can still
because
be an amazing female role, but it's a quintessentially female role, which is different from a quintessentially male role.
But there are hardly
role.
Any.
And those things should change. Like, it shouldn't just be that the male protagonist is always the hero.
But how many of those? How many of those female-led Oscar-type films do we get a year? Like
not
two,
many.
Two,
not,
yeah, exactly.
That's the big problem.
Two or three.
Yeah.
And then there's like 20 male films.
You have more female heroes now, which is starting to happen.
Which is great.
Well, there's big things happening. You know, Captain Marvel, Brie Larson. Like, it's, you know, going to be a huge Marvel franchise.
Wonder Woman was great.
Wonder Woman. And in the TV world, you know, there's like Fleabag.
Well, you had a female star of the recent Star Wars, right? Or the first Star Wars that came back. What's her name?
Daisy Ridley as well. Yeah. But there's also kind of, you know, even in comedies, you know, whether it's Sharon Horgan doing Catastrophe, or as we've said, with Fleabag.
So take away an award now. So it was Casey Affleck and all those guys, and then Emma, like,
Yeah. Like, I'm just wondering though. I'm genuinely trying to ask myself, like, would I watch more female-led stuff? Like,
I think you would if it was put in front of you. You know, the other.
I mean,
thing,
I loved
the
Orange
thing
is the New Black when that
the
came.
The other
out,
thing
initially.
Is the this whole BBC pay scandal.
Yeah,
which is I think is a bit of a shame, and it's a smart move on the government's behalf to kind of undermine the BBC on kind of fairness grounds when they're essentially just trying to like cut the shit out of the institution because they feel like it's not really supporting their agenda enough, but. It is kind of mad that, and that this guy who's this city grandee, so they've put a man in charge of making sure that female pay is equal to men's pay in the BBC.
I don't think that's a problem if he does his job.
Well, no, but he's just come out and said, BBC pay, women let it happen.
What?
You just can't write it. You can't write
it. What he's essentially saying is feminism. You want a job done properly, give it to a man.
Yeah. But the amazing thing is, that's
ridiculous.
And it is insane, the disparity that was... And it's worse, I think, probably in ITV. I mean, people are saying it's worse. No one really knows, but it's worse in ITV and Channel 4.
I wouldn't know. I just feel like if people are doing the same job and they have around the same value, then they should be paid the same.
Yeah. I was on the Today programme the day that it got announced, right? And John Humphreys
is on it.
Noticeable in his absence that day, right? Because he's getting like 650 grand, which is 30% less than Michelle Hussein and Sarah Kenny. And I was just like,
more.
But I was just like, sorry, yeah, 30% more. But they were like, as soon as the mic's off, they were rinsing.
What
were they saying? Well, they were just basically kind of going, it's a joke. Well, they were going, well, we could have just clocked off at 7:30. Do you know what I mean? 30%
It is a fucking joke.
But the thing is, it's kind of constructed though, isn't it? Because the thing is that, you know, Channel 4, ITV, Sky, I bet you it's exactly the same
100%,
thing.
100%, but it's not the point. The point is that you probably go into any major national institution, whether it's a big national bank, whether it's, you know, a big media company, production company, the fields that we all work in, you'd find the same disparity.
You're right. And it is a joke. I mean, what we're coming down to is the bottom line, isn't it? It's a fucking boys' club.
Yeah,
boys' club. It's a club. Yeah. It's a boys' club because boards, it all starts at board level, you know, and they said...
But I reckon it feeds into the whole thing. It's like if you have films with male protagonists all the time where men are the heroes and you're watching that from, you know, from day dot, and it becomes like a cultural thing that we all kind of feed into. It's like men are the leaders, we are doing this, and I think you change it from the cultural level, from you bring kids up watching films, you know, there's an amazing
Doctor Who's a woman now, Wonder Woman was a massive blockbuster.
There's an amazing thing you can buy which changes the he for she or her for him for her on all the books that you read your kids growing up. So all your favourite children's novels, you can, if it's your daughter, you can read them, but suddenly it's a female protagonist for your favourite book.
So Harry becomes Harriet Potter.
Exactly.
Like that.
That's great.
And I think we need to start, you know,
what's
changing
that called,
it.
That thing?
I don't know what it's called.
That's Google really, really clever.
The changer later.
What's your impression though? Because obviously, you know, we're outside of the film industry. Like, why aren't there more sort of, yes, obviously, Jodie Whittaker, fantastic. She's become the first ever female doctor. Why is she the first ever female doctor though?
Because I think people just were like, the doctor's a man. Simple as that. People are like, the doctor's a man. Well, he's not. He's an alien with two hearts. it's an alien with two hearts. So essentially, once it regenerates, surely it can turn into whatever it wants to turn into. Or whatever, you know, whatever.
All these men got really upset about it, though. Like, all these bro flicks.
Some women were upset. Yeah. Some women were upset. But, like, I didn't bat an eyelid. I was at home. I saw it. I did not bat an eyelid. I didn't even go, gasp. I was just like, oh, yeah, Jodie Whittaker, cool. She's amazing. You know, my kids don't watch it, but they were watching the announcement, and they don't care. And I'm trying to raid. They don't care. They don't care that it was a girl.
What about Black Bond?
Big shout, isn't
Noel
it?
Clark, Black Bond.
Mate, I will never get that. Can you imagine the fucking? They said Idris was too street. Can you think them fuckers would ever give me that? Mate, there's not a sniff.
I think we need a street Bond.
I think. I'm sorry, Barbara Broccoli is not going to have a street Bond.
Could you do us a quick?
But it's, I mean, like, here's the thing. The funny thing is I'm not really fucking street anyway. That's the funny thing about it.
But
you know
he's the real politic of it, because like Noel was saying, you know, he doesn't play in certain markets. Like the Russians and the Chinese, they're the two biggest film markets.
That's the consideration.
They wouldn't buy.
That's the consideration.
They wouldn't buy. He's black.
The only. It would have to be like Denzel or Will Smith to get by, to transcend that sort of thing, or John Boyega maybe.
Right.
It would have to be someone like
two
like
or
that.
Three black. International
I think John.
Movie
I tell you what I do think. I tell you what I do think. It's worth putting money on this. I think not this person, whoever this person is going to be, But the next one,
yeah,
I would say John Boyega could be James Bond.
Yeah.
Be interesting to see that, wouldn't
it? I would say he could be James Bond. He is now at this young age. Yeah. It's not like Idris and those guys are older. Mm. He's now at this young age transcended sort of race because of
Star Wars
and a lot of the stuff he's doing.
Pacific Rim now, isn't
Pacific Rim. He would be accepted.
Historically, Bonds are ancient,
Bond.
Man.
No, Daniel Craig was, Daniel Craig was 39. He was 39. Yeah, but I reckon like John's like 25 now. Mm. Not this person. Let this person do it for like fucking whatever it's going to be, 6 years.
Not Tom Hiddleston, though, please.
No, it won't be. It will take 7 years to do three fucking films. Mm. And then by the time John's like 32, 33,
yeah.
Bring him in. And I think he will, by that point, will be able to transcend it and he could be the first black. We should put money on that.
He's going
to
call it now. I wonder what the odds are. Someone on Twitter will tell us.
So should we all get back together in 7 years' time and call in this bet?
I won't be with you. I won't be fucking with you because I would have betted and made some fucking money. I would be in the fucking Costa del Sol on a yacht.
So where are we going to be?
Fuck knows. It depends where you put the money on.
Nah, mate.
If you put the money on, you'll be on the yacht next to me.
It's going to be worth it.
We've got to go big, man. You've got to put like a grand on that.
On that bombshell, it just leaves me to say thank you so much, Noel, have you got anything coming up that you want to tell us about that's coming out?
It's weirdly stuff I can't tell you about, actually. Got a big TV show for Sky.
That's big, isn't it?
Yeah, it's big. It's really big. But I don't think they haven't announced it, so I'm not allowed to talk about
it. Okay, cool.
And I've got this other show on BBC that I can't talk about, which is like.
So just lots of stuff, basically, you can't talk about.
Yeah.
Look out for Noel somewhere doing something that we can't tell you about.
We've got a film called 10x10, which is coming out at some point with Luke Evans, starring Luke Evans and Kelly Riley.
I like him a lot.
Thriller that I wrote. So I'm not in that, but I'm a tiny bit, but not anything important, like an extra. That I wrote, and so that's coming out. That'll be nice, and just go after, man. Just getting on with it.
Well, listen, Noel Clark, thank you so much for coming on News Roast. There are live News Roasts that are going to be announced shortly. But look, keep subscribing, downloading,
review the ones on iTunes.
Thank you very much.
And tell these guys to get some fucking good biscuits in.
We'll see you soon.
See you later.
Luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.